Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We'll hear a debate on the topic global warming, pro and con. The participants in the debate, arguing that global warming is a real man-made threat to the future of the world, Dr. Bruce Johansson, a communications professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and arguing that the current so-called global warming is merely part of a natural cycle of climate variation, which has been tracked over several thousand years, Dr. Robert Smith, a professor of chemistry at UNO. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, November 20th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Hugh Cowden, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today we are dealing with the hot topic, no pun intended, of global warming. Leading scientists around the world have concluded that global warming is indeed real and presents a serious threat to the future of the world. Others conclude that there is unusual global warming going on, but that is in fact occurring, but that human behavior is not contributing to it. Still, other scientists insist that whatever global warming is occurring now is a normal part of the ongoing cycle of climate change and does not present a threat to mankind. Our two panelists today are on opposite sides of this issue. The pro side will be taken by Dr. Bruce Johansson, a communication professor at UNO who has published 24 books, including 3 volumes entitled Global Warming in the 21st Century, as well as another volume, The Prager Handbook of Solutions to Global Warming. The con side will be presented by Dr. Robert Smith, a professor of chemistry at UNO, who, as a scientist, has studied global warming and has concluded that it does not, in fact, present a threat to the future of the world. Dr. Smith has made both oral and written presentations on this subject, including articles in the Omaha World Herald, and he is the author or co-author of 36 articles in various scientific journals. So we'll begin with Dr. Johansson.
Well, Hugh, it's such an honor to be here and to be introduced and to be carried here by you. It takes me back to my first evening in Omaha, June the 1st, 1982, when, you know, Hugh picked me up over at, you know, Epley Field for an interview. I had subsisted on half an ounce of, you know, airplane peanuts. They lost my suitcase. Suitcase ended up in, you know, Hong Kong. This, you couldn't make this up. Hugh picked me up. He brought me first thing to right outside here, and he says, order the prime rib. I did. Hugh was the best prime rib I've had before or since. Somehow, with no suitcase, I got the job. I'm still here, of course. Anyway, I've been writing a book these days called Hot Air, Hard Science, in which I go into the anti-warming or dissident side. I'm fascinated by the, you know, arguments. I just, you know, some of them are scientific, some of them aren't. The arguments I've seen infer that this isn't science, it's theology, or that it's mass psychosis, or that Al Gore has us engaged in a mass hypnotic trance. In the good old days, we called him Al Bohr, but not anymore. I've heard arguments. I mean, I'm fascinated by the range and scope of all this stuff. I've heard arguments that we need to step on the gas and burn more fossil fuels, because if we don't, we're going to go into an ice age. There's a Russian scientist who argues that the ice age will start in 4 years. However, most of the folks who, argue this, give themselves more room than that. Now, understand, there's been a great deal of talk about this issue. There are, of course, other forcings, scientists call them that, other things that shape climate. I mean, it isn't linear with the, the level of CO2 methane at all. The Earth's, orbit, over a long term, both sometimes plays a role in beginning and, ending, ice ages. There, and if you go back into the, history of climate, the Earth has done a perfectly good job of being almost, there's one argument that asserts that the Earth was almost totally covered with ice at one time, and then there have been other spells where we've had no, ice at all. All of this before there was, anybody burning any fossil fuels at all. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas also. I mean, it has a role. There are El Niño and La Niña cycles, which force temperatures up and down in the short range, and sometimes by quite a bit. So there's all of these different things happening at the same time. However, a lot of the forcings, and I'll add to this the activity of the sun, which varies also, they tend to have a cyclical variance, and over time they tend to average out. Some of these are very, very long cycles. The Earth's oscillations of its orbit is tens of thousands of years. The La Niña, El Niño, is just a few years. I've found in studying this issue that the main fault line between those who think that global warming is an important issue and that humankind has an important role, and those who don't, tends to fall along those who think that greenhouse gases are an important forcing, and those who think that, other factors are more important. This tends to be, if you can see who's on which side by looking at how people fall out on this issue. Having said this, this is a short, very, very short survey of the, issue. Having said all this, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxides at all, gases which retain heat in the lower atmosphere, are not having a debate with us. I mean, debate is something that people do. That they have no party affiliation. They didn't vote for George Bush or not. They have no economic, you know, interest. They don't care if we burn fossil fuels or not. And they don't care if we understand their role in the atmosphere or not. All they do is retain heat. And the more of them we put up, the more heat they retain. There's one forcing, I mean, one thing that shapes the climate that's been increasing on a regular basis for about the last 150 years, and that's greenhouse gases. They're fairly potent. Carbon dioxide is measured in parts per billion. Ethane in parts per billion. So they don't make up much of the, you know, atmosphere. I mean, if you're interested in a planet where they do, there's Venus. And 95% CO2 with an atmosphere hot enough to melt lead. That's what it can do. I mean, of course, on Earth, we're under 1%, you know, and so it's, but it doesn't take much of a change to change the climate. Scientists have now drilled ice cores in Antarctica going back approximately 800,000 to 850,000 years, and they can, you know, they can estimate from these the amount of CO2 and other things in the atmosphere at different times in the past. And if you plot these, you'll find that there's a fairly consistent cycle. Okay, if you go down to approximately 180 ppm, you'll see an ice age. If you go up to approximately 280 ppm, you'll probably see a climate that isn't too unlike what we, you know, have now. Okay, the carbon dioxide reading in the atmosphere as we stand here is approximately 385. Okay, and it's gone up. I mean, it's going up faster, actually, than it ever has. I mean, ever since they've kept, you know, detailed records in the 1950s. Where would 385 ppm put us in the past? We would probably have to go back to the Pliocene about 2 to 3 billion years ago to get that high. Now, how come it's not that hot now? Okay, well, there's thermal inertia. It takes about 50 years in the air and about 150 or so in the oceans for the exhaust that we, you know, the CO2 and, you know, other gases that we emit today to become, you know, heat that we can feel. So since, I mean, right now we're feeling the heat from approximately the late 50s, early 60s, the global emissions of these gases since that time have gone up approximately 400%. So you can see, if the relationship holds, what we're in for in 50 years. And this is a reason why so many scientists are urging that things be done. However, our diplomacy and our debates are often based on what we feel right now. It's hard to get folks, you know, out there to react 50 years ahead. I could always keep it up, but I think I'll stop right here. So,
here you go. Dr. Smith, your turn.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to be here also, and it's nice to meet Dr. Johansson, who I've read a lot about. Very good professor from everything that I've heard. I am going to take a little bit different view of things than Dr. Johansson does. Before I get started, though, I want to point out that I am a scientist, and in science, numbers are important. All the talk about global warming, greenhouse effect, et cetera, frequently, particularly the lay readers who read about this particular subject, don't have numbers associated with it. I'm going to be showing you several numbers, lots of numbers today. I'm also a baseball fan, and baseball fans are interested in numbers also. Now, my wife gets on me on this, but I should say, there are particular people who are addicted to alcohol. Some people addicted to gambling. I'm addicted to baseballreference.com. Spend a lot more time looking at that than is really good for my professional life. Baseball fans like to debate the numbers. Who was the greatest pitcher in the live ball era, for example? The criteria I would use is someone who had at least 250 victories and a career ERA under 3. And there are 4 pitchers who have done that, and at the end of this talk, if you know any of them, but I'll give you a hint, one of them has a longstanding connection to Omaha. In fact, I can see his picture on the back wall. By the way, I grew up in St. Louis listening to him pitch on KMOX. I actually have a figurine of him on my shelf. For those of you who don't know, that's Bob Gibson. So strike that one from the other 4. You need to come up with the other 3 who had that particular criteria. I'm also an educator. I'm interested in educating people. I don't have a political horse in this particular race. I really don't care what people think regarding greenhouse gases, global warming, the political ramifications, et cetera, but I do want my students to learn how to think, and in order to think, they need to know all the information. What I go through in all my classes, what is the greenhouse effect? Is the greenhouse effect good or bad? And then what gas accounts for the vast majority of the greenhouse effect? Well, the greenhouse effect is in which visible and near ultraviolet radiation passes through the Earth's atmosphere, for which the atmosphere is transparent at those wavelengths. This radiation strikes the Earth and scatters off, essentially reflects off the Earth, but loses energy in the process and is radiated as infrared with longer wavelengths. The atmosphere is not transparent to the infrared, and there are certain gases that absorb this particular radiation and then re-emit it back toward the Earth, thereby warming the surface more than it would be otherwise. The estimated effect of the estimated temperature difference due to the greenhouse effect itself is 33 degrees Celsius. This is based on treating the Earth as a black body radiator, which I'm sure everyone's going to be very thankful I don't go into the nitty-gritty about. I see Professor Jack Casher over there. He, longtime professor in the physics department, he could probably even give you a better explanation of black body radiation. But suffice it to say that the temperature that the Earth should be based on its black body radiation is 255 Kelvin. Actual surface temperature is 33 degrees Kelvin, higher than that, 33 degrees Celsius. put that in perspective, the average high temperature in July in Omaha, Nebraska is about 88 degrees Fahrenheit. Without the greenhouse effect, the average high temperature in July would be under 30 degrees Fahrenheit, which would give us the climate of about northern Canada. Now, I ask my students all the time in my classes whether the greenhouse effect is a good thing or a bad thing. And invariably, if they know anything about it at all, they'll say, well, it's bad, because that's what they've been taught. And then I ask them, well, would you like to live in northern Canada? And they say, no, it's too cold there. Well, that's what Omaha would be like without the greenhouse effect. So unless you think northern Canada is a great place to live, you have to admit the greenhouse effect is a good thing. Percent components of dry air have nitrogen. Now, to be a greenhouse gas, you have to have a vibrational mode that allows it to absorb in the infrared. Diatomic molecules such as nitrogen and oxygen are incapable of absorbing in the infrared. Argon, neon, and helium being single atoms are also incapable of absorbing in the infrared. Carbon dioxide, as Professor Johansson pointed out, is 380 parts per million, which would make it 0.038%. The next question I ask my students, what gas accounts for 90 to 95% of this greenhouse effect? And in 18 years of teaching chemistry, I've had about 10 students who actually knew the answer. Considering how important the greenhouse effect is, how ubiquitous talk about it is in the popular media and in books, I find it amazing that so few students actually know what gas accounts for the vast majority of it. Professor Johansson's already mentioned it. It's water vapor. Water vapor is 1 to 4% of the atmosphere. Now, the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere varies depending upon the temperature and the relative humidity. When it's cold, such as in November and December and January in Omaha, there's not much water vapor because the temperatures are so low, which is why you use a humidifier on your furnace. In warmer temperatures, the percent goes up to about 4%. Carbon dioxide at 0.038%. Methane, 0.00017%, and then nitrous oxide, also known as laughing gas, 0.00005%. Each of these gases has what's called a global warming multiplier. Carbon dioxide, by definition, has a multiplier of 1. Methane and nitrous oxide up around 12 to 20. But part of the reason of that is that there's so little of those gases in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide and water vapor absorb infrared at about the same wavelengths, not exactly the same, but pretty close. Consequently, the amount of infrared absorbed by those particular gases are close to saturation and increases in them, say a doubling of the carbon dioxide concentration is not going to double the amount of infrared that carbon dioxide absorbs. Those changes in absorption with concentration follow a logarithmic scale known as Beer's Law, which, again, I'm sure you're going to be thankful I don't go into, but which we teach our undergraduates about all the time. One summer, several years ago, I wanted to see what the average high temperature in July was in Omaha, Nebraska. I went to the library and looked through old Omaha World Herald newspapers at their temperature data and got for a 10-year period, taking 10 years so as to damp out annual fluctuations, that in the years 1941 to 1950, the average high temperature in Omaha was just under 88 degrees Fahrenheit. 50 years later, it would seem to me that if global warming were a major problem, that this temperature would significantly increase. And actually, it's a little bit lower. For the years 91 to 2000, average high temperature was 85.2 degrees, with a slightly larger standard deviation, meaning that the range that the temperatures fell in a little bit larger. Now, I've got to admit that these particular dates were chosen on purpose. I knew that the decade 41 to 50 had been a fairly warm one, and that the decade 91 to 2000 had been a fairly cool one, that the temperatures had actually had not increased that much during that time period. I also knew that any increases in global warming or in surface temperatures are going to be manifested more in winter months than in summer months. The warming that is occurring, and I'll show you some data on that, is manifested not in our summer months, but in our winter months, so that low temperatures are a little bit higher than what they would be otherwise. Now, rather than go through and get temperature data from all the newspapers over all the world for each month, I rely on the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia, who've been collecting average global temperatures for the last 150 years. This shows how those temperatures have changed. It shows that in the late 19th century, temperatures were fairly stable, then increased at a particular rate from 1910 to 1940. From 1940 to the late 80s, they decreased slightly and then started increasing again in the late 80s, actually the late 70s or early 80s. But one particular temperature stands out. That was in 1998, which was an El Nino year, when there was a large amount of warm water that upwelled in the eastern Pacific. Actually, right now, this data only extends to, I think, 2004, 2005. Temperatures are actually slightly going down. This last year was a fairly cool year. Going to evaluate temperatures in science, scientists use the Kelvin scale because that places zero at the correct position, the temperature below which you cannot go. It shows that temperatures over this 100-year period have increased 0.8 degrees Celsius or 0.8 Kelvin. This shows a graph from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change showing how temperatures have varied over the last 11 or 1,200 years. Shows in particular two particular periods. One is known as the medieval warm period, originally called the medieval climate optimum, with high temperatures centered about AD 1100. And then the Little Ice Age was lasted for 400 or 500 years, with low temperatures occurring at about the year 1700. Temperatures since 1700 then have been slowly increasing at a rate of about, averaged out, 0.8 degrees Celsius per century. And that rate of increase, about 0.8 degrees Celsius per century, has been occurring during the Industrial Revolution, starting about 1850 when carbon dioxide levels were increasing, and prior to that. That the increased amount of carbon dioxide has not seemed to affect the rate of change of temperatures. Well, then that leads to the question how one can accurately measure the Earth's temperature in the ancient past. And this particular proxy, as it's called, is of recent origin, that this was really developed within the last 20 years when mass spectrometers and the ability to extract cores from both the seabed and from glaciers was developed. The particular isotopes here, oxygen 18 and 16, their ratio to each other is a fairly accurate proxy for ancient temperatures because we can't go back in time and take the temperature of the Earth with a thermometer. So we have to rely on other things that we can measure. This shows some data taken from the European project to Ice Core Antarctica. That's a European concern. It also shows temperature data from the Vostok station, which is on the Vostok glacier close to the South Pole. The Vostok station was originally started by the Russians, and then in the 1990s became a joint project with the Russians, the Americans, and the French. And isn't that an interesting combination? But it shows that temperatures have been relatively high for the last 10,000 years during the geological period known as the Holocene Epoch. Now, prior to that, there had been an ice age. There had, in fact, been several ice ages with interglacial periods when the temperatures were warm. Notice here that at least for Antarctica, the previous interglacial period was actually warmer than the one currently. In fact, most of the interglacial periods had had slightly warmer temperatures than Antarctica is experiencing now. In fact, looking at this, you can see why people think, as do I, that there's a new ice age coming, that there is one that comes about every 10 to 12,000 years following the ice ages. You also notice that temperatures are more unstable during the ice ages than they are during the interglacial warm periods in between. In the 1970s, people aware of this data were pointing out that a new ice age is coming. Of course, it's going to come between sometime now and 2,000 years, and most of us are probably not going to ever see it. In fact, most of our grandchildren, I'm sure, are probably not going to see it, but it definitely is coming. This shows similar data from the North Greenland Ice Core Project from the University of Copenhagen. It shows temperatures being relatively stable during the Holocene. Remember, that's the time period since the last ice age. Temperatures right now are about minus 31 degrees Celsius, pretty cold, at the peak of the Greenland ice sheet. You also notice that during the Holocene, temperatures have been both warmer and cooler than they are now. This shows the same data spread out just over the Holocene epoch. Current temperatures are about at the average for the last 10,000 years. You'll see periods where temperatures are appreciably higher, periods where temperatures were appreciably lower. I have a friend, by the way, who was stationed in Greenland for a year, and he talks about people coming to this ice sheet and taking these ice core. The scientists who actually developed the process, the technique of measuring temperature by the oxygen isotopic ratios, was a Danish scientist, and he got to be at a scientific conference where that particular scientist was honored. This shows us another temperature set of temperature data from the seabed in the Sargasso Sea. The Sargasso Sea is a portion of the mid-Atlantic around Bermuda. It's surrounded by four different ocean currents, causing the sediments at the bottom of the ocean be relatively stable. In this case, the sediments contain calcium carbonate being formed from oxygen in the atmosphere, which also contains the oxygen 18 isotope, and it's that ratio to the 16 isotope that allows them to measure the temperatures at the surface when the calcium carbonate was formed. The calcium carbonate being formed by a particular type of plankton, which then dies and the calcium carbonate drops to the ocean bottom. You can see that there's a little ice age that occurred about 300 years ago, medieval warm period about 900 to 1,000 years ago. There's a cold period that corresponds to the Dark Ages, and then a warm period known as the medieval warm period that occurred about 2,500 years ago. In fact, for the Station S, which is off Bermuda, temperatures are slightly below the average for the last 3,000 years. As Professor Johansson pointed out, about 150 years ago, the concentration of carbon dioxide was about 280 parts per million, and today, 150 years later, it's about 380 parts per million. So it's definitely going up, but the increased carbon dioxide has not seemed to affect the rate of change for temperatures over those 300 years. That the 150 years before the Industrial Revolution, temperatures were increasing at the same rate they have afterward. Actually, the percent increases for carbon dioxide, 25%, temperatures 0.3% over the past 100 years. Well, if not carbon dioxide, and I don't believe it's carbon dioxide, whether anthropomorphic or otherwise, what could be causing these cycles? Because if anything's causing it, it's got to be cyclic itself. Carbon dioxide does not have any external forcing agent that's causing it to go up and down independently of temperature. But there are other factors that do have particular cycles to them. This shows sunspot cycles. Sunspots were discovered in the early 17th century. Actually, Galileo used to entertain house guests by showing them sunspots on his telescope. So we've been able to count the number of sunspots for the last 400 years, and we have very good data regarding them. Now, sunspots go through an 11-year cycle where the number of sunspots goes up and then goes down. Furthermore, there are other cycles that relate to the amplitude of the number of sunspots within the 11-year sunspot cycle. So there's the 11-year cycle, there's the 87-year Gleisberg cycle, and the 210-year de Vries cycle, the latter two being pertaining to the amplitude of the number of sunspots during the 11-year sunspot cycle. Well, what does this have to do with temperatures? Well, let me ask the audience a question if I could. Perhaps this isn't going to get on the radio, but we'll see who knows the answer, and Dr. Kasher is not allowed to answer it. Why does a comet have a tail? Does anyone, now everybody knows, for the radio's sake, there's long pauses. Everyone's looking at me with puzzled faces saying, I don't know why a comet has a tail. Dr. Kasher. Okay, yeah. Dr. Kasher knows. What causes the northern and southern lights? Well, the answer is it's a solar wind. We can't measure solar activity from 150 years ago directly. As with temperatures, we have to use proxies to get the solar activity, cheap proxies being carbon-14 isotopes, beryllium-10 isotopes, and the number of sunspots. So the solar wind, what might the solar wind have to do with temperatures? Well, let's first examine what the solar wind is. The sun puts off about 6.7 billion tons of electrons and protons each hour, radiating isotropically, that means in all directions from the sun, and it varies markedly with the sunspot activity. When scientists speak of solar activity, what they're really talking about are the sunspots. Sunspots are dark areas on the sun caused by vast magnetic storms. When there are a lot of sunspots, the sun is putting out more irradiance, and it's also putting out more solar wind. The solar wind can vary tremendously depending upon the number of sunspots. The more sunspots there are, the more solar wind there is. And it's actually the solar wind going by a comet that causes it to have a tail. The solar wind can also get trapped in the Earth's magnetic field and come in at either pole, exciting the oxygen and nitrogen in the atmosphere, causing them to emit light, causing the northern and southern lights. The Earth's magnetic field, called the magnetospheres, actually protects the Earth from the solar wind so that the solar wind isn't blowing away our atmosphere. Actually, Venus, not having a magnetic field, is having a portion of its atmosphere being blown away. Venus actually has a tail just like a comet does that actually extends to the Earth's orbital radius. So here's the hypothesis, and I'm not saying that this is absolutely correct, but it seems to make sense to me. It is just a hypothesis at this point that the solar wind, which increases with sunspot activity, blows away cosmic radiation. Cosmic radiation is that radiation coming from all points in the universe impinging upon the Earth's atmosphere. That with less cosmic radiation, because the solar wind is blowing it away, you have lower ionization in the atmosphere. And with lower ionization in the atmosphere, you have fewer low-level clouds, which allows more of the sun's irradiance to penetrate. We have more clouds. A portion of the sun's irradiance is going to be reflected from the clouds back into space, so it never has a chance to produce the greenhouse effect. Oh, so that there's a direct connection, or possibly a direct connection, between solar wind and surface temperatures. These are my conclusions. One is that the greenhouse effect is good. Everybody should recognize that. Unless you want to live in northern Canada, the greenhouse effect is good. That the Earth is experiencing an ongoing 300-year-old warming trend of about 0.8 degrees Celsius, that's 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit per century, and this warming trend predates the Industrial Revolution. That the current warming trend is part of an irregular 1,500-year natural cycle, probably driven by solar activity. and not carbon dioxide, whether anthropomorphic or otherwise. And temperatures have been warmer than they are today by at least 2 to 3 degrees Celsius in the last 3,000 years. And then finally, because we're just closing a political season, one of the few prominent politicians who actually has brains. And for those of you who can't see that, that's my bouquet to the governor from Alaska. And I guess because she's so good-looking, we'll leave her up. And my wife doesn't mind my infatuation with her because she knows it's non-sexual.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. I do have a question. We don't have a lot of time. As you know, many of the scientists, including the group in the United Nations and many others, including both presidential candidates, believe that there is serious global warming that presents a threat. But with regard to the scientists, don't they have the same data that you do?
Yes. Now, when it comes to data, there are different ways of appealing to persuasion. One is to appeal to authority, saying you've got to believe this because 5 out of 6 dentists say there needs to be fluoride in drinking water. Or you can appeal to emotion, saying, well, we need to believe this because all the polar bears are dying. Or you can appeal to data. I'm making the appeal to data, that the data shows that temperature variations are cyclic. The ice age temperatures are due to orbital dynamics, as Professor Johansson pointed out. The 1,500-year cycle, probably due to the solar wind, though it's certainly due to some sort of solar forcing, because the greenhouse gases don't have any internal cyclic forcing that would cause them to go up and down independently of temperature.
I can't help but bring up, some of you have watched the Today Show. Ann Curry is coming down from 16,000 feet on Mount Kilimanjaro. 80% of the ice is gone. What would account for this?
I do not know.
Just to, I mean, add a tail, the, I mean, Arctic ice cap 2 years ago lost almost 1/4 of its summer surface area. You know, do you have an explanation for that?
The Arctic ice cap varies by season. It melts in the summer, and it regenerates in the winter. And it's been doing that for millennia. The Greenland ice sheet, the Antarctic ice sheet, are not. In fact, the Antarctic ice sheet is growing. The Arctic ice sheet melts and regenerates because it's in the water. That water is an effective way of conducting temperatures. In fact, it's the absorption of heat by the oceans and then distribution through the currents, which provides a damping effect for temperature variations. But the Arctic, if you look at the temperatures for the Greenland data, Greenland is still very, very cold, as is the Arctic. That no temperature variations are going to occur in that region that are going to significantly affect the amount of ice that's present on the Greenland ice cap. Same goes for Antarctica. Melting of the polar ice cap is a seasonal occurrence. Occurs every summer and then is regenerated every winter.
Perhaps you misunderstood me. It lost 1/4 of its surface area in September 2007 versus September .2006. I mean, I'm not talking a seasonal cycle here. I mean, I understand it. You know, it varies by a season. I mean, that's only sensible. The size of the Arctic ice cap, same season over same season, has been going down a great deal.
I don't have the particular data showing that, but it would not surprise me that there's large variations from one year to another. But the temperature data for the global perspective shows that there's no significant increase in temperatures, that it's part of a natural cycle. Variations from year to year occur, but they're small in nature. And the temperature variations even over a century are only less than 1 degree Celsius.
Dr. Johansson, this one is for you. The United Nations Panel on Climate Change predicts a sea level rise of between 7 and 23 inches during the next century. This averages out to 12 or 13 inches, or about an eighth of an inch a year. Should we really be concerned about such a tiny amount?
In Omaha, no. Okay, if you're on the beach in Florida, yes. Also, please bear in mind thermal inertia. Okay, the estimate for a particular date, you know, isn't really the important item, especially in the ocean. I mean, I'll remind you that the thermal inertia of the ocean is about 150 years behind the actual, you know, emissions. What you have to look at is not the forecast for a specific date, but the amount of, you know, melting or sea level rise, which will be, as they say, in the pipeline approximately 150 years after that. You know, you have to think in these terms. James Hansen, who is the director of the Goddard Center of NASA, who's from Denison, he thinks that at the end of this century we could have enough melting in the pipeline to raise the oceans 150 years or so hence, about 80 feet. So, I mean, that you can interpret that, you can debate that. If he's even, I mean, half right, it's a big deal.
Dr. Smith, this one is, I have to ask you this. Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma maintains that the controversy over global warming is a conspiracy cooked up by the news media. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. In fact, my last slide showing Governor Palin, I was originally going to think of saying that it was supposed to be Senator Inhofe, but that somebody had switched a picture of Tina Fey with me. I've read about Senator Inhofe and some of his speeches on the floor of the U.S. Senate. I don't believe the news media, pardon me saying this, I don't think the news media could conspire to change their wife's oil. So saying that they could conspire to do this particular thing, I think is giving them too much credit.
I'll take that as a yes. We have time for one more question. This is for Dr. Johansson. What specifically would you have each of us do in order to help prevent whatever global warming there is, particularly the way you interpret it?
How much time do we have?
A minute.
Okay, I think the easiest thing to do then is to reach into my pack here and pull out my book. Read the book. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, angles there. And the book, I mean, it's just a part of it. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't even pretend to get started. But, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of options.
Well, I didn't mean to push your book here, but you know that it exists.
I am. I mean, I have to take it. I mean, where I can get it, right?
I'm afraid we're out of time.
Yeah. Right on time.
I want to thank both of them, Dr. Johansson and Dr. Smith, for taking the time to come up here and teaching us a little about this subject. Our thanks also to the Omaha Press Club audience here for your questions, and also to our KIOS radio audience. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a debate on the topic Global Warming, Pro and Con. The participants were Dr. Bruce Johansson, a communications professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Dr. Robert Smith, a professor of chemistry at UNO. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, November 20th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.